Welcome, I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. Today, we're discussing episode 3 of Undisclosed series on the State versus Willie Vesey. In this episode, the team continued investigating the case of the man who, in the 1990s, was convicted of second-degree murder for his alleged involvement in a shooting on the streets of Philadelphia, despite an alibi provided by his employer proving his whereabouts at the time of the shooting. He was convicted and has spent over 25 years in prison. With us today is one of the hosts of Undisclosed, Colin Miller. How you doing, Colin?
Good, John. How are you?
Really good. Also with us is Amber Hunt. Amber Hunt is a journalist. She's a true crime author, and she's a host of the wonderful Accused podcast, which recently wrapped its second season. This iteration explored the unsolved murder of Raitha Welch. Amber, in the second season, first of all, I've not been able to listen to the podcast yet, but my understanding is that the person convicted of murdering Raitha Welch also had an alibi. Could you tell us a little bit about the second season and the alibi?
Sure thing. Thanks for having me. Raitha Welch was she was a 54-year-old woman living in Newport, Kentucky, which is, I mean, when I'm working in Cincinnati, I'm looking over the river at Newport, so it's right in our area. She was found dead in her apartment, and she counseled prison inmates. So she was one of those people. She was very devout Christian. She'd go to church, and one of the ways she spent her free time was to go to jails and prisons to counsel folk. And so the investigation quickly zeroed in on a man named William Virgil, because he was one of the people she had counseled. And obviously, she's a little higher risk victim because she did sort of have some of these convicts come into her house and into her life and so forth. So William Virgil was convicted in 1988. He is now out. And the point of our season was to take a look. He is out because his conviction was overturned after DNA testing. But there's nobody pointing to his case on the prosecutor's side anyway, saying, yeah, we got this one wrong. They're saying, well, we just don't have enough anymore to convict him again. And so the point of our investigation was, okay, so which scenario happened here? Did the guilty guy walk away? Was his conviction too flimsy to hold up? And if so, then why is that the case? Or did they have it wrong from the beginning?
Does it go into possible mistakes in the DNA testing?
It does. No, they're not contesting the DNA results. And when you mention alibi too, which is, it's driving me nuts when we're thinking about all the nuances in these cases and how many of them are, they share similarities. So in this case, he had an alibi. It wasn't as ironclad as the one in the Vesey case, because there's no boss saying so, but he did have women who were girlfriends of his who said, well, he was with me that night, but it's a little bit slippery because the body was found post-mortem. She'd been dead for, you know, an indeterminate amount of time, a couple of days at least. And so pinning down precisely when it happened is part of the problem here.
Yes, I have to say, after listening to this last episode of Undisclosed, it was a bit of a gut punch because, you know, when you hear the circumstances of the alibi, it just seems so difficult to refute. You know, Colin, do you have any theories on why he was convicted despite this alibi?
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough in 2017 to look back to 1992, but what Richard Leo and Jim Tranum essentially said was, we were in the infancy of understanding that there could be false confessions back in 1992. The Innocence Project had just started. We just had the first cases where people were exonerated despite giving confessions. And I just think it was a case where they're sitting around the courtroom. They're told Willie Vesey confessed. There's no evidence that he was physically abused. It wasn't an especially lengthy interrogation. And so therefore, despite the fact that he had no criminal record, some great character witnesses, and really this ironclad alibi, I just think the jurors couldn't get past this confession.
Well, yeah, and when I have to say, as I said, it was a gut punch to listen to the episode. But then I started saying, well, okay, you know, if there was an eyewitness and a confession, that is very hard to overcome, I think. Do we know what the racial makeup and other demographic information was for the jury?
We don't. Pennsylvania is fairly limited in terms of what you're able to get. So we have the voir dire, which is the questions asked the prospective jurors, and it's just juror numbers. Sometimes they'll mention the juror's last name, but not the first name. Nothing about race. Sometimes they'll go into religion because this was a death penalty case. And so you'll sometimes have jurors saying, I have a religious objection to the death penalty, and they can't be seated. But yeah, we don't know race. We don't know age. We just have some last names sprinkled into the voir dire.
And actually, it sounded like Jules Epstein was saying that a death-qualified jury is harder to convince of police misconduct, like a false confession type thing. Why would that be necessarily?
Yeah, well, if you break it down, it's right there in the voir dire, the questions to the jurors. They are asked, do you have a moral, an ethical, a religious objection to the death penalty? And to be quote-unquote death-qualified, the person has to answer, no, I'd be fully inclined to impose the death penalty if I think the facts and the evidence merit it. And so the point that Jules is making is to say those very same jurors who have objections to the death penalty have a pretty good likelihood of also buying into this being a case of coercion or police misconduct or a false confession. And so by classifying this as a death penalty case, you're automatically excluding a decent subset of potential jurors who probably would have more sympathy to the defense.
Yeah, it seemed like there were some very wily moves on the part of the prosecutor in this case. And I guess this was also the police. In terms of the way they attacked the time card evidence. Again, only the totality of the context makes you understand why the jury would make that decision. You know, having an eyewitness, a confession, and the prosecutor is able to say, you know, there's a lot of human error involved in these time cards. That's the only thing to me that can possibly justify the verdict that the jury found.
Yeah, and Jules himself will say, Mark Gilson, the prosecutor in this case, is an excellent prosecutor. He's great in the courtroom. And you read through the transcripts, you're not there in the courtroom. We don't have the recording. But yeah, I can see how he could be convincing to a Philadelphia jury. He really, with what he had to work with, did the best job that he could have in planting this doubt in the jurors' minds about this time card. And you know, it is something that obviously was convincing to the jury, despite this time card showing 4 hours before he punched in, 4 hours after the murder he punched out, and yet somehow get a conviction in the case.
Do you mind if I ask, do you think that's because he straight up believes that the time card evidence is not reliable? I mean, does he actually believe that?
I don't know. I called him. We had a nice phone conversation. He said he would be fine talking with me for the podcast, but he had to get approval from the conviction review unit, who is reviewing Willie Vesey's case right now. And at least as of today, the conviction review unit has not given approval for him to speak publicly about the case. And so I'm left to speculate whether he actually believes this is a false time card or not. And I kind of have to think he does. It's tough to say. I don't have the prosecutorial mind, but I just can't conceptualize of a way that he could prosecute this case as a death penalty case while thinking, no, this guy had an alibi and he can't be guilty of the crime.
Another thing I thought that was just diabolical was the police officers using a corrected confession to support that it was, in fact, real as opposed to a fake one. Because I have to say, had I been confronted with that as a juror, that would have been compelling to me that a suspect had gone through the effort to correct a minor point on their confession, would have said, well, you know, they're not being waterboarded here. This is something they're putting some care to for whatever set of reasons. By the way, now I feel silly for feeling that way, but that has become an actual police tactic is very disturbing.
That happened in the Elizabeth Andes case that we covered in season one, too. The confession that Bob Young in that case gave after 15 hours of interrogation, he had gone in and hand corrected certain points and then somehow in 1978 did not get convicted, which is a miracle.
Colin, was the fact that VC never used the alibi during his supposed confession ever actually brought up at trial? I mean, I know we get it now, but did the defense attorney at that time make that point?
Yeah, Jules Epstein certainly raised this point. It's interesting because, right, the prosecutor at trial is saying, well, look, if he had this true alibi, he didn't mention it during his confession. He didn't mention it during the police interrogation. And he used that to convince the jury that this is a fake alibi. And the defense, rightfully, I think, and we raised this in the podcast, said, Look, this is a case where if it's a legitimate alibi, he's being interrogated in June. This was your average Friday night. He was a dishwasher at Houlihan's. He's not going to know that he was working that night because he wasn't committing the murder. This was any Friday night he could have been washing dishes at the Houlihan's. And so, yeah, the argument is sort of the fact that he didn't mention or almost bolsters the claim that this is a legitimate alibi that he didn't recall at the time of the interrogation. Support for Undisclosed comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org number 3030.
I have no idea if you would have this information, Colin, but was anybody aware of any security cameras at the restaurant that could prove that Willie was there or, you know, at neighboring businesses? Or even there's security cameras on buses now, the bus that he took to work. Did Mr. Epstein search for that kind of evidence?
There's no mention of that. What they did do during the trial is they actually took an old school video camera into the Houlihan's and sort of did a video demonstration for the jurors showing, oh, here's Susan Myers, the manager, and here's her office, and here is the dishwashing station, and here is where Seth Schramm, the back of the house manager, was. And they tried to show the jury how difficult it would be for Willie Vesey to have been at work and slipped out undetected for a significant period of time. But yeah, there's no indication from the case files or the trial transcripts that there were, in fact, video cameras either in the restaurant or adjoining businesses.
You also talked a bit about character evidence in the episode with the several witnesses who were vouching for Willie Vesey's good character. My understanding, Amber, is that in your second season case that there were bad character issues in terms of the suspect in your case. How did you deal with them on the podcast?
Yeah, that was a really interesting thing to decide even to adopt a case where the we knew that we risked people not caring about either the suspect or the victim as much as they might if they both had squeaky clean pasts. But we felt it was pretty important to tackle a case like this because it's these people who are sort of on the fringes who sometimes have the least amount of recourse when they are in this sort of position. They, you know, nobody cares. So when they've got a wrongful conviction, people shrug and say, oh, well, they probably belonged there anyway. And this case really was very interesting because there were some compelling witnesses for the prosecution who testified about the defendant, William Virgil, but they were, as Colin would call it, unreliable narrators. One was a jailhouse snitch, and so we delved into the issues surrounding using snitches in trials. Another was an ex-girlfriend who had admitted to trying to shoot Virgil and trying to run him over with her car. So there are questions about whether she might be totally truthful when she says he was also planning to kill somebody.
And of course, there's the whole Joey Watkins case, who was basically convicted on the basis of a sort of free-floating character assassination that was constant in his trial, which brings up the topic, you know, in terms of should character evidence be admissible at all? You know, you bring up in the episode, Colin, that it wasn't always that way in terms of, you know, it's not useful in civil cases, but it is in criminal cases. But it would seem like a slippery slope in criminal cases as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's really so tough to say. I mean, I don't know, if I sort of pose it to the two of you, you know, John or Amber, people you know in your life, if they were to be accused of a crime, do you think you could say with any certainty, no, this is definitely a person who I know, under no circumstances would they commit a robbery or would they commit a shooting?
Maybe two people.
Yeah, exactly.
Some might be like, well, show me what you got.
Exactly. It's true, though, because, you know, the nature of humanity, you know, I always, you know, until I started working on this show, I never thought in a million years I could give a false confession. Now, I believe it would take me maybe 14 minutes to crack. and they would, you know, and there's no bone breaking involved. There's just some subtle, you know, sarcastic humor would probably cut me to the quick and I would be done. So I think we have a lot of cherished illusions about ourselves. One of which is that we really know the nature of people. So no, I could absolutely say there are people that I've never seen in any way be violent, or that I've seen, you know, show high moral values at times when, you know, other people might not have. Like a friend of mine got arrested because he refused to lie, you know. And if somebody said, this guy lied, I'd say, no, I'm sorry, he didn't. You know, he just doesn't do that, you know, but that's very rare, you know. And in this case, it's super strange that they require that they go about it in this sideways route where you're allowed to talk about what other people say about this person's character, which just makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really bizarre how Pennsylvania does it where, yeah, exactly. You can come in and say Willie Vesey has a reputation in the neighborhood for being peaceful and nonviolent, but I can't actually share my own opinion knowing him for 20 to 23 years. On the other hand, I can kind of see it in the sense of what you both just said, and I'm sort of in the same, but I have maybe one or two people in my life who I could say, no, there's no way they could ever commit a crime. No, but beyond that, it's, you know, who are you testifying for? It's friends, coworkers, family members, and you see them in a certain environment, in a certain context. You rarely see them in sort of the push comes to shove type situation. And yeah, I have family members, friends who I think are great, but I've never really seen them pushed. And that's usually what a criminal case is. They were pushed in some way. That the prosecution is claiming there's some motive, that there's something that precipitated this beyond what you see in day-to-day life. And I have no idea, coworkers or friends, if placed in that environment, how they would respond. I might think they're a good person and my day-to-day interactions think that they're peaceable, but I would have no idea. On the other hand, as Amber said, if you have someone who has some acrimony with the defendant, who is a rival, an ex, etc., they've probably seen that person in the worst light, and they probably have a motive to say they're a bad person, and they might paint them with a broad brush that way, despite the fact that in other areas of their life, they're a perfectly reasonable, understanding person.
And I think also people want to feel like when they live their lives in what they think is a good and moral manner, that it counts for something. And that if you were ever accused of something horrible and you knew you didn't do it, that your friends would come and say, but he's a great guy. He took me to the gas station when I needed gas for my car. You know, one would hope that the good things you do in life would count for something at some point. And that, you know, when you were at your lowest ebb, when you were accused of something horrible, that would help. So, you know, I can see why there's an impulse to allow that evidence as well.
I see it, but I also get really, I mean, Ted Bundy could have found character witnesses. A lot of people thought he was just super swell.
Yeah, he used to work at a suicide hotline.
And Rule would have testified on his behalf.
Exactly.
Until a certain point.
Yeah. And by the way, Colin, I loved how humbly you dropped the fact that you had something to do with that the state of Illinois asked you to look into character evidence. And then, oh, yeah, the Supreme Court agreed with you. That was nice. You were. Did you draw up an amicus brief for that?
Well, I have an amicus brief that I just finished now that's going to go to the Supreme Court. But yeah, this thing for Illinois, I mean, this is.
Oh, yeah, I just dropped that. Yeah, it's going to the Supreme Court. Anyway, so. You're a badass.
It's funny,
Colin.
Though. It's just, I mean, I have a friend who also has a blog who's a law professor, and we both started about the same time. We find it funny because it kind of gives you this false expertise where I started this evidence blog, and all of a sudden, within the first few months of becoming a professor, you get all these calls from the media or even the Supreme Court of Illinois, and they just say, oh, you're the person who runs the evidence blog. You must know what you're talking about. And it's sort of led to these things falling into my lap, and that was one that I was happy to be able to work on. This I was like a 100-page report where I sort of compared each Illinois evidentiary principle to the policies across the country as to rules of evidence.
And the Supreme Court agreed with you.
I'm sorry, but he slides all of this stuff in as subtly as he opens with a proverb.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Also, he drops the bombshell that he used to work at Wendy's. Come on. By the way, that's why you got all the cred on your blog, dude. It's they sense your work in fast food. At any rate, now I had heard actually that a false confession actually figures into the Accused podcast as well on this season. But this time it came from a jailhouse informant who claimed that the defendant confessed. Is that what occurred?
Yeah.
Is it problematic?
Well,
Amber?
It is a big deal because it's not only we've heard about jailhouse informants giving false testimony. That's a thing. There are books written about it. There's no question that happens. But this one is so incredibly orchestrated that it's pretty shocking. Because he's not just saying that he lied. He's saying that he was given a cheat sheet by prosecutors in the case, told to memorize details of the case, and then testified to those details. And it's the specificity of his testimony that helps nail this conviction. Because, geez, well, why would he know that she was stabbed that many times and what kind of car she drove unless the defendant really did confess to him? Well, he's saying that actually that was slid to him by investigators.
And is there any follow-up in terms of investigating the police misconduct in that case?
There is. Right now, they're in the midst of a civil trial. And I know that, they're the Innocence Project lawyers who are helping William Virgil. Their primary goal right now is to try to get the guy some money to live the rest of his life. So that's what they're working on, and there'll be depositions. I do get a sense that because some of the reporting in the podcast were highlighted some misstatements and so forth, that then they'll decide after that whether they should go for anything more.
The confession in Willie Vesey's case was convincing in some respect, partially because he wasn't interrogated for an excessively long time, at least not that we have records of. And there were a few mitigating things that did not immediately scream false confession, certainly not in 1992. But what occurred to me is I just wonder if shock may have played into him falsely confessing. He had to have been stunned to be arrested at 6 a.m. in the morning. A man who there is no record of him having any police interactions up until then. There's no he's a man who's not lived his life, in constant fear of the police coming into his house at 6 a.m. I have to say, just that dislocation must have been incredibly powerful for him.
Yeah, that certainly false confession experts talk about that as being something that can prompt a false confession. You add to that, he hadn't slept, he had been drinking heavily, and as you say, this is a man who, as far as we can tell, had lived his life by the law and had no reason to believe that he would be implicated in a crime, certainly a murder, and here he is at 6 a.m., he's hauled into the police station, and this is a man who is described sort of by his coworkers. Seth Schramm says, look, this is a compliant guy. He was always smiling. He would basically do what you wanted him to do. He was very, very, very compliant and wouldn't argue with what people had to say. And you can imagine him just being hauled in and being in shock, being tired, having intoxication play a role, and just deciding, okay, I'm going to go along with it. And I want this interrogation to end. I don't want it to proceed. And it doesn't have to get to the stage where it is mentally coercive or him being attacked. It's just these external and internal conditions that facilitate this false confession.
The first false confession story I ever covered stuck with me because the guy said, I confessed because I knew they wouldn't find any physical evidence. So I just told them what they wanted to hear. And then I figured, the evidence would bear out. But they didn't realize that confession was then the evidence.
Right. Yeah, and that's sort of what Jim Tranum, who interviewed Willie, had to say, was sort of very similar. He knew he didn't do it. He knew they wouldn't find any evidence to tie him to this crime, and that played a big role in him deciding he was going to confess.
I thought it was interesting that he was so reticent to actually give his opinion on whether the confession was false itself. Is he forbidden from doing that just as a professional?
Yeah, that's sort of interesting. This is something that would have been allowed up until about 1981. And so what we had was the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan by John Hinckley, and he raised an insanity defense, and the psychiatrist who evaluated him reached the conclusion he is not guilty by reason of insanity, and of course he was found not guilty, and he was thereafter institutionalized. And as a result, Congress decided, we don't like this. We're going to pass this new evidence rule, Federal Rule of Evidence 704B. And it says if it's a criminal case and the mental state of the suspect is an essential element of either a crime or a defense, expert witnesses cannot offer that conclusion. And so what that means in the false confession context is someone like Jim Tranum in the courtroom is certainly allowed to testify about factors that go into false confessions and allowed to testify about what he observed in a case, but is not allowed to tell the jury, this was a false confession. That's my conclusion. And so that's why, yeah, it was sort of nice to be able to get him actually to say on the podcast what he thought, because in a courtroom, the jurors wouldn't be able to hear that.
And there's some question as to whether the field of false confessions, because it's actually fairly new, is in fact science, or is it junk science at this point? Many people feel the whole field of psychology is junk science because it's difficult to prove empirically. Do you feel like it's still in its infancy, or do you feel like it's actually useful in court context?
Yeah, and this is something where there's sort of two related things, two related fields where this has come up recently. One is, can we have experts in false confessions? And the second is, can we have experts on eyewitness misidentification, and specifically the issues inherent in cross-racial eyewitness identifications? And there's been a real split among courts on both of those issues as to whether jurors should hear that expert testimony. On the one hand, is it junk science? On the other hand, is it reliable? And then if it is reliable, is it still tipping the scales too much in the defense side, or should the jurors be able to offer their own conclusions in a case? And I think, you know, the more information, the better. Certainly the prosecution can rebut it with their own experts, their own evidence. But I think absolutely the jurors should be able to hear, look, there are experts out there who think these are factors contributing to false confessions. And in the eyewitness case, look, there have been studies done that show people of a certain race just aren't good at identifying people of a different race. And that is a factor with DNA exonerations that's led to a lot of false convictions.
Yeah, again, I think it's something that average people don't feel like. It never occurred to me that transracial identifications might be more difficult. But it absolutely makes sense. I think if your context is a certain racial makeup, you know, it does make it harder for you to do that. And it sounds like it's a problem that happens quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. It is something that I feel like almost every week I see a case that crops up where there was an issue with a cross-racial identification. And yeah, it's certainly something that is really being hashed out on a week-by-week basis in the courtrooms.
In the Willie Vesey case, the prosecutors made a lot of hay that not only did he confess, but he also behaved in a way that indicated he was guilty, that he tried to hide, and that in fact, was a second confession. Apparently, that is implied in your second season of The Accused as well, that one of the suspects also sort of confessed in the way that he acted.
Yeah, they held some of his behavior against him for sure, which is always a little interesting to me, partly because just a personal experience, you know, when somebody in my family died and I handled it so much, you know, in such a completely different manner than, you know, my sister did, for example. I just know that there's no real set of rules governing behavior in stressful situations. But in this case, it was interesting because there's a moment in the investigation where the police, they've found a bloody shoe print in the bathroom of the victim, and she was killed in her bathtub, or her body was found there. So they find a bloody shoe print, and this is a big deal. And so when they're interviewing the suspect, William Virgil, they say, hey, can we see your shoes? And he pulls off a shoe willingly and hands it over. And then apparently an investigator says, well, geez, this looks a lot like the pattern at the death scene. And give me your other shoe. And he's like, no, I'm not giving you both my shoes, especially now that I know that you think it's connected to a murder. So he balks and fights about it. And that behavior, the no, I don't want to give you my shoes off of my feet, was then used against him in trial as, see, he wasn't cooperative, and a guilty person wouldn't be cooperative. I read it a little differently as, like, dude, those are my shoes. But that's apparently not how the jury saw it.
Well, I can see if that behavior could be offered into evidence as long as the context is made clear. But it's difficult to say because I would need to hear the tone of how it was said, of how the interaction happened, I guess, in order to judge it correctly.
It's just tough whenever you're looking at anybody's behavior. I've covered many cases where a grief-stricken husband was underreactive. He wasn't crying enough. So therefore, we zero in on him because he might be guilty. Or he's overreactive. He's crying when he sees the vacuum cleaner because his wife will never be able to vacuum again. So it always seems like no matter what the behavior is, it's used against the person they want it to be, whether that's fair or not.
Yes, and we saw that in the Adnan Syed case where they didn't feel he reacted appropriately to Haman Lee's death.
And Amanda Knox was doing cartwheels, and what does that mean?
Yes, it comes up over and over. But I feel like for juries, that is compelling. Having been in a jury room, you hear all kinds of rationalizations of people saying, well, but he, why wasn't he mad about that? Or you try to, it's very difficult to stay evidence-based in social situations, which a jury room is.
I'll have to take your word for it. Someday they're going to let me in a jury room. So far, I have not been chosen.
Well, I have a feeling after you do podcasts like The Accused, it's not going to happen. I have to say, Undisclosed is apparently my bid at never serving on a jury again. But as I said, the two times I've done it, I have felt grateful for the experience and grateful to have been a part of it. And I recommend it. Don't dodge it next time, folks. It's an important thing, and it elucidates so much human behavior and will change your view of how all of this works. I just wanted to talk for a moment about the two detectives who were involved in this, Devlin and Rorell, who are a part of the Wacker squad, as it were. As we know, they took some part of the Sean Thomas case that we discussed in the last few episodes. Are there going to be more episodes involving them at this point, Colin?
Yeah, this is something where we – it's kind of tough because – there are actually some files in the Sean Thomas case that the Pennsylvania Innocence Project got that sort of is what led them to give us the Willie Vesey case. But those documents and some related files are currently under seal, filed with the court, meaning that this is sort of like the bombshell that I have in Adnan's case that
you
I keep wanting to tell you, but I can't. But it's sort of now I'm getting the same treatment from them where they're saying, look, we have these documents, but they're under seal. They're important. We have a general sense of what they might kind of say, but we don't have them yet. So hopefully this seal will be lifted soon. And then I think we would be discussing some of the details of these detectives a little bit more.
Is there a statute of limitations in terms of – because, these sound like some very serious issues of misconduct for them. Would they still be liable considering this happened all the way back in 1992?
They could. I mean, it's going to depend in terms of statute of limitations. Those would have generally run. But if it's something where, for instance, their misconduct wasn't disclosed by the state until now, it wasn't discoverable through due diligence, in that case, we would say the statute of limitations is told, meaning that you simply have to file the claim within a reasonable time after learning of this behavior. So this seemingly is something that Pennsylvania Innocence Project could not have discovered until recently.
I wanted to get into the very first episode of this particular run of Undisclosed because, as you mentioned, the film Rashomon was mentioned. And I have to say, it was very difficult for me to parse the wildly divergent eyewitness testimony. It just made it seem like the actions of what happened were nearly incomprehensible. How many of those witnesses were actually brought up? Was it just Denise Mitchell or were other eyewitnesses actually testifying at the trial?
It was Denise Mitchell. It was Andrew Bagwell. And then for the defense, it was Charles King, Chucky King, who was called to testify. So we didn't have Efren Gonzalez, who was the other person who was shot. We didn't have Angel Martinez or his wife. We didn't have Henry Montero, who was the person who was in the row house seeing the shooting. We might have had Lloyd Hicks. I'm not sure if Lloyd Hicks testified or not. I can't remember whether he actually testified at trial. But most of these witnesses were not called to testify.
Yeah. Have you been able to actually speak with any of them?
No, we've really tried. The Pennsylvania Innocence Project has as well. The only one is Andrew Bagwell. Andrew Bagwell, you might recall, was the person who said, "I was walking shoulder to shoulder with the Jamaican John Lewis when he was shot." And he was called to testify at trial, as I said. And we haven't been able to speak to him. Jim at the Pennsylvania Innocence Project did talk to him. At first, he, according to Jim, was very reluctant, said, "I don't remember this at all. I didn't testify." And then Jim confronted him with his testimony and police statement, and just wasn't really very helpful at all. Basically, was evasive and wasn't really cooperating. And this, it's been tough. We've looked up any number of phone numbers, made any number of calls, tried to get these people to talk, and it's just been really tough to track them down.
The woman who said ultimately that she actually knew the gunman, but she didn't disclose that when she was first interviewed. Has anybody re-interviewed her recently?
That was Denise Mitchell, I believe.
Yeah, and so Denise Mitchell, we'll discuss in our fourth episode on Willie Vesey. She did make a statement after trial, and it's fairly intriguing what she had to say after trial, so we'll cover that. She also, in terms of these new documents that are currently under seal, there's apparently something important involving Denise Mitchell as well. The Pennsylvania Innocence Project says they were in contact with her up until a few years ago. They lost contact. They haven't been able to locate her. We've searched. We haven't found her yet. But yeah, there'll be at least a couple of new pieces of information in episode four that deal with what she's said since the conviction in this case.
I am glad I set you up for a cliffhanger
Yeah, well done, Amber. My understanding is the accused has some issues with eyewitnesses disagreeing with physical evidence in this season.
Yeah, actually, and the interesting part is figuring out and trying to understand why certain witnesses weren't put on the stand way back when. It's especially frustrating because now some of them are dead, so I've certainly tried to find as many as I could. But for example, there's a gentleman who says that he heard his upstairs neighbor, who Retha Welch, the victim, he heard her walking around after the time that police say they believe she was killed. And he was really glossed over at trial. He testified, but it was very short and truncated. And then he supposedly saw her car leaving the apartment complex where she lived on Saturday when her body wasn't found until Monday. And police's theory is that she was killed on Thursday. So it's just kind of a mess in terms of what witnesses said versus what police presented as their theory. We also have another, there's an interesting twist in this story in that the lawyers who are involved now believe that the main person that they would like to have considered as an alternate suspect was actually shot dead by police Saturday, and this woman is found on Monday, and it all happens within a mile of her house, and he's shot dead by police because he is aggressively confronting a girlfriend's house with a knife in his hand, and our victim was stabbed to death. So, and that wasn't really touched on much at trial at all.
Was there any justification for not touching on it at the trial?
Just that they had the right guy, they said, and therefore he wasn't worthy of it wasn't worth investigating anybody else.
Was this a particularly crime-ridden area? I mean, they could conceivably make the comment, "Look, there's a stabbing every day here," or anything like that.
In Newport, there's absolutely a good amount of vice crime. So, but it's mostly like gambling and prostitution. When it comes to murders, we're talking 2 to 3 a year, not an enormous amount.
Well, I'm sure that police have that issue all the time when it is their job to interact with people involved in criminal behavior. They can see patterns that don't necessarily exist, And so I could see making the argument that, listen, yes, this happened at the same time, but it actually didn't have anything to do with the other thing that happened over here. In retrospect, it's much harder to make that argument. But, I'm just trying to think of psychological justifications at this point. I'm just trying to make people seem competent, Amber. That's what
I
I'm
don't
here for.
disagree. I don't
Okay.
disagree because the truth is, if it had been properly investigated at the time, I might be looking at information in the file right now that's, oh, well, that's why they didn't think it was connected. And of course it wasn't connected, and let's move on from that. But because it wasn't looked at, then we're just left to speculate right now and try to piece together, you know, a puzzle that is missing a lot of pieces.
Oh, and actually, I wanted to talk about a piece of news that involved Undisclosed recently. The Supreme Court of Georgia recently ruled against a case that was supported by Undisclosed. Colin, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, this was our second season case, the Joey Watkins case out of Rome, Georgia. And as you might recall, this was something where we just had the trial transcript. And unlike in our current Philadelphia cases that just have the transcript, they actually had a recording. The court reporter in the case had done a recording of the trial, and that's actually what she used to type up the trial transcript. And we had filed a motion under Georgia law to get a copy of the court reporting, that recording, so we could then play it on the podcast. And the Supreme Court of Georgia recently ruled, they made two rulings essentially. So this statute in Georgia says that you're able to access court records. And the state had said, well, the right to access does not include the right to copy. And so even though we could have a reporter could look at the court files, they couldn't make physical copies, whether it be of documents or recordings for themselves. And the Supreme Court of Georgia, I think rightfully, said the right to access includes the right to copy, which I think is very important if you're cross-referencing documents and, you know, putting things up on the board and comparing and drawing lines. The second part of the ruling, though, and this is why the court ruled against us, they said that, and this statute covers court records, they found that court records as a term only covers things that are filed with a court. And the way this works is the court reporter records the trial. From that recording, they type up the trial transcript, and only the transcript is submitted to the court. So the Supreme Court of Georgia says that recording is not a court record and therefore is not covered by the statute, and therefore Undisclosed, you don't get access to this court recording.
So a recording made in court is not necessarily a court recording, is what they're saying.
Basically, that is how they get there. And they quoted Alexander Hamilton in the introduction. And
fancy.
I think, they got fancy and they struck us down. And I mean, Amber, what do you think as a reporter with this ruling saying that, you know, whether it be a reporter or someone like us, lawyer podcasters, can't get a physical recording done in the courtroom?
I think it's actually really counterproductive, because when you're just looking, I mean, one of the magics I have found in doing a podcast is that the audio makes so much difference in how people interpret what was said and understanding tone and, you know, and getting sarcasm and all of that. So to me, it's really unfortunate, because instead of just letting people hear what was said, you're then allowing it to be dramatized. Maybe you've got an actor who's reading it, or my inflection might be wrong if I'm the host and I'm reading it. I would much rather actually hear how things were said, because it might be different than how I read those words in black and white. It feels less transparent to me.
That's what I was about to say, is that being that it's not an adulterated copy, it's not, to our knowledge, it hasn't been edited, I feel like the general transparency of the court should be weighed more in this particular case. But do you feel like it might have opened a Pandora's box, you know, like, oh, well, then we should be able to get the notes of the janitor who took care of the court? Or I don't know. I mean, is there a possible justification in that respect?
Well, I don't know. I mean, first, I agree with Amber. Sort of the analogy that came to my mind was, have you two ever seen the movie Mulholland Drive, the David Lynch movie?
No, I haven't seen it.
No.
You see everything, Colin. And you worked at Wendy's.
My husband keeps saying I should see that, so now I'm...
There's a scene where Naomi Watts is running lines for this movie she's auditioning for, and she delivers it a certain way, sort of very sweetly. She's sort of this neophyte coming to Hollywood. And then later you see the audition, and it's an audition for an adult movie, and the same words that she said when she was sort of running through it with the person she was staying with are quite different than when she's giving this actual audition. So, yeah, I think it's important to hear inflections and how the lines are being delivered. And, John, I mean, that might be a concern that they had, that if you open the door to these recordings, there's a slippery slope to other things that then could be obtainable. there is a nice thing. There's a final footnote sort of there in the opinion, and it does say, if you're an attorney and you're appealing and you have reason to believe that there's an error in the transcript or there's a lack of clarity, that's a case where the lawyer in the case can actually petition and get the recording to compare the two. So I think that's a bit of a safety valve there. I don't think it's a complete solution or panacea to the situation created by the court, but it's at least something that allows for lawyers to gain access to the recording.
Oh, and there was actually some chatter on Twitter this week that there might be a ruling in the Adnan Syed case because of the court schedule, and yet there was not. Do you have any kind of idea about how much longer we're dealing with?
Yeah, so the rule of thumb, according to Steve Klepper, he is a Maryland appellate attorney, is usually about 3 to 12 months from oral arguments. And oral arguments were in June. And what happens essentially with the Court of Special Appeals is they have a conference where they sort of discuss these cases each month. And then you look for the opinions essentially the last Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of each month. So we were looking there for early or late October, early November for the October conference. And now we're looking for the November conference. So in essence, if you're on a non-Syed watch, the last Tuesday of every month, you're looking those few days for the opinion to come out. So our next watch is sort of the end of November.
And do you read anything into the fact that it's taking so long?
No, it's really tough to say. There are so many different reasons that can lead to the delay. I mean, this is a complicated case. There are three issues the Court of Appeals or Court of Special Appeals is considering. There are many sub-issues to those issues. They know this is almost certainly a case that's going to be appealed, so they want to sort of dot those I's and cross those T's and make sure they're issuing an opinion that is going to not be reversed on appeal. So it could show that there's some uncertainty among the judges. It could, on the other hand, just be the judges wanting to write the best opinion they can and making sure it's going to be insulated from reversal.
Yeah, to me, the thorniest issue was the issue of whether it had jurisdiction, because it wasn't clear whether COSA had actually given the case back to Judge Welsh in that manner. That, to me, seemed incredibly complex, and I still don't understand it. I actually spoke with Justin Brown a couple weeks ago, and I was like, please explain it. And he did, and I still don't understand it. So so I don't know. Maybe you can explain it to me, Colin. But
well, I mean, it ties into sort of that slippery slope you just mentioned in the Joy Watkins case. Essentially, the question is this. There's this 10-year statute of limitations that applies to raise arguments in Maryland court. Adnan Syed and his attorney did not raise the cell tower issue with this AT&T disclaimer until those 10 years had passed. And the defense is saying, for a variety of reasons, you should allow this appeal past the 10-year deadline. And the state is saying, A, those arguments are wrong, but B, if you allow this, that's going to open the floodgates where all of a sudden people incarcerated in Maryland for two decades, three decades can bring these old claims. And that is why it's a delicate issue for the court to address, because on the one hand, they want to make sure that innocent defendants have an avenue for relief. On the other hand, they don't want people being able to challenge their convictions too far past the due date such that the conviction is never settled. The family of the victim never has sort of this finality in the case.
Well, that makes sense. Now, I have many listener questions. The first one I got was a guy from named Brent Hughes. And it's not a question. It's actually just a statement. But but I think it's elucidating somewhat. Said, you asked why DAs are elected. And I did, in fact, and not hired by the local government. My understanding in California is that the DA and sheriff are directly governed by the attorney general. That allows those departments to operate without the threat of local government firing them. They are elected locally to allow that local influence. I think the threat of being fired for cases you chose to prosecute or people you arrested by the CAO or the Board of Supervisors could lead to much more corruption and weak law enforcement. That's my opinion based on what I have researched. Thank you, Brent Hughes. You're awesome. We always want to hear from you. Here's an actual question from Chad Junkermeyer. He says that the police departments that are part of the series that you have done are full of incompetence, lazy police detectives, and or outright corruption. Do you think that this is pretty common in all police departments, or do you think that today's police departments are the same, better, or worse? Amber?
That's so hard. I actually I'm really hoping that next season we have police cooperation, because I would love to highlight the good work that goes on. Obviously, we focus more on anomalies. That's what makes them news. So we're looking at cases that, you know, that we can learn something from. And so far in the cases we've covered, that has meant, you know, maybe trying to rid the department of confirmation bias and trying to be mindful of, you know, some civil rights issues and the issues that arise out of jailhouse informant testimony. They don't come across very positively in the pieces that we've done so far. But I don't think that on the whole, this is normal. I just think that when these problems do arise, it is so difficult to have a case looked at once a conviction is done. And once police have made up their minds, it's very difficult to change them. And so that's why I think these are important issues to look at. But no, I don't think that this is across the board, you know, how all officers work. I know so many amazing detectives, and some really cold, horribly difficult cases have been solved because of their shoe leather work. So it's tricky, because it ends up looking like, you know, we're not in favor of police, and that's not true. We're absolutely in favor of police being mindful of these issues that can arise.
We have another question from Ben Scott, who said, did Willie Vesey typically work on a Friday? Were his days that he worked typically fixed? And have you spoken to any jurors? Colin, do you have that information?
Yeah, so one, in terms of jurors, as I said, with the voir dire, we just don't have that juror information to be able to contact them. Two, in terms of Willie Vesey working on Friday nights, I haven't done an exhaustive review of his records. I know he did work a decent number of Friday nights because, as we played in the episode, they were serving 800, 900 customers that night. They needed more dishwashers than usual. It was their busiest night, and so he did work a good number of Fridays. It wasn't a set schedule. He would sometimes work different days, different weeks, and so it wasn't necessarily fixed exactly what nights he would be working at the Houlihan's.
Now we've got one from Annie Cal, 78, who says, I live in Sweden, and I totally love your podcast. I've learned so much about the American justice system, and I am also utterly shocked by some of the things I hear. But the thing that strikes me the most when I listen to your podcast is, who the hell are these prosecutors and investigators that don't give a F about sending innocent people to jail? That's just mind-blowing. How do they sleep at night? And not only is the wrong person in jail, the families of the victims never get true justice. I, for one, would love to hear from some prosecutors on this program. I would love for them to write into us. I would love for them to come on, because I would love to hear just psychologically how they do their job. Not, by the way, that I'm suggesting that they're immoral or they've done something horrible. I would imagine most of them haven't. But they do have to, on a daily basis, make decisions that gravely affect people's lives. And they do have to make their peace with that and go home at night and have dinner and go to sleep with their families. So I really am curious how, on a day-to-day basis, they deal with the weight of those decisions.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, in terms of the question you asked to Amber a minute ago, I sort of analogize it. The article that I read on the episode, or one of us read, where it was sort of marveling at this whacker squad and their high clearance rate, despite the fact they were brought in well after this crime had been committed. And I sort of analogize it to that same era in baseball, and like articles marveling about all these baseball players hitting this huge number of home runs. And of course, it turns out that was a red flag. These are the people using steroids and performance enhancing drugs. And it's almost like you could probably go back to that time period, especially pre-recorded interrogations, and say, Baltimore, 1990s, Ritz and McGillivary in the Adnan Syed case. Look at their huge clearance rate that they had. Look at the clearance rate of the whacker squad. And I don't think it's typical of every police department, but I think if you looked back to those records and saw who had these sort of aberrational clearance rates, those are the people who were willing to cut corners. They thought they were sort of gods. They thought they knew better than anyone else, and therefore sort of throw the rule book out and do whatever you need to get the conviction and don't look back.
Yeah, we idolize those people in TV shows, you know, the ones who toss out the rule book. But in real life, there are usually pretty severe consequences for doing that. I'm thinking of House, for the record.
So, Amber, you mentioned that that you've ended the second season. Are you going to be doing any updates on The Accused coming soon?
We are, actually. We've got a couple things in the works. First off, the season one case, Elizabeth Andes, that one is going to haunt me until we freaking solve the thing. So even though we don't update the feed with information, we do still get tips and we conduct interviews. And at some point, we're going to have enough that we think is warrants an updated episode for that one. For the second season, the nice thing about the William Virgil case is that there is this civil case going on. And hopefully we'll be able to learn more from players who wouldn't agree to talk to us because they've been deposed or they're about to be deposed. And so hopefully we will learn more about their side of things and we'll absolutely update those cases.
And Colin, can you tell me a little bit about the direction of Undisclosed in the next few months?
Yeah, so after the Willie VC case, we're going to be talking about another Philadelphia case, the Terrence Lewis case. Early 2018, we're going to have a fourth Philadelphia case, the Chester Holman case, and we believe these, including the Sean Thomas case, are four cases of young African-American men who were wrongfully convicted in Philadelphia. In terms of some other content coming up in 2018, I'm hoping we're about to close the deal, I think, on having our first case of a female who we think was wrongfully convicted, and so I'm going to be meeting with the attorney on that next month, and I hope we're going to be able to do that. And there's another case we're going to be doing in 2018, which we think there's a strong case of innocence. And if it is established, this will end up, at least at the moment, being the person who is released from prison who has spent the longest time in prison for a wrongful conviction. So those are some of the cases we have on the tap in 2018.
Well, thank you so much, Colin. And thank you so much, Amber. It's lovely to talk to you again. And I can't wait to listen to the second season of Accused. I'm so looking forward to it.
Thank you so much. I always love talking to you. And I am glad we are Twitter friends now.
Yes. We have that intimacy.
All right. Thanks, John. Thanks, Amber.
Thanks, guys. And that's it for The Addendum this week. We will be back next week with a brand new episode. Remember, all the case documents and photos are posted at undisclosed-podcast.com, as well as a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to. I've been donating my fees to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project this season, and if you feel like you want to help them, you can visit their website, innocenceprojectpa.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle, @UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I'm going to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon. You killed it once again this week, as well as Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media for our audio production, Patrick Cortez, who composed our addenda theme, and once again, Meethal Telhan, who is our project manager. Have a great week, y'all. Looking forward to talking to you once again.